I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. How often have you heard someone say, I am so stressed and overwhelmed, I feel burned out? And a common refrain, and the antidote is often take a day off, get to bed early, take deep breaths, take care of yourself. And while there's nothing wrong with that advice, does it really get to the root of the problem? Our guest, Christina Maslach, has identified six mismatches that can lead to burnout, and they involve workload, control, reward, community, fairness, and values. It's called the Maslach Burnout Inventory. She's a pioneer and leading authority on burnout, wrote a book called The Truth About Burnout. She's also a professor emerita of psychology at the University of California in Berkeley. Got up early to join us today on Radio Times. Christina Maslach, nice to have you with us on the show.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
You're very welcome. Kristen Lee has done investigative work on burnout, resilience, and well-being. She's a clinical social worker, lead faculty for behavioral science at Northeastern University, author of a book called Mentelligence, A New Psychology of Thinking, and she joins us from the studios of WGBH in Boston. And Kristen Lee, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you both with us. And let me start with some really basic questions here. And Christina, I will start with you because I think we know the symptoms of burnout, but I want to make sure that we are all on the same page. What do you see? And I ask that in part because oftentimes we don't know we're burned out until well after the fact. So what are the symptoms?
Well, let me just first say, it's not just symptoms in the sense of a disease. It really is an experience that people are having. And so the characteristic of that experience are, one, stress. I mean, you're getting the kind of exhaustion that comes with feeling stressed about work or whatever. But with burnout, we also see sort of going along with this, a sense in which people are getting very negative and about the job, you know, to kind of take this job and shove it. They don't do as good a job. They don't treat people as well. And they can eventually also have a very negative evaluation of themselves, feeling, you know, this is a mistake. I'm not good at this. I shouldn't be here, perhaps later on leading to depression. So it's really those three things in a kind of a, interwoven that refers to burnout. But it's a good question you ask it because it is such an evocative term that I think people use it to mean all kinds of things. And so there's always that, perhaps that issue that we're not on the same page when we use it.
Well, let me get to, Kristen, let me get you in on the conversation as well. How do you see burnout? And is there a physical component along with a psychological one?
Absolutely. So one of the ways it's been defined is a syndrome of emotional exhaustion. And so we certainly see that physical side. What the American Psychological Association reports is that, to your earlier point, a lot of times people don't know that they're experiencing burnt out until they actually show up with the physical symptoms. So actually the number one reason people go to the emergency room is for heart palpitations, thinking that they're having a heart attack. But beyond that, the cognitive and psychological pieces, as has been said, you know, leave us to a place where we're not only exhausted, but oftentimes we feel cynical or disconnected from the meaning of our work. And that obviously can lead to a lot of various health issues, including obesity, insomnia, anxiety, and depression.
Kristen, do you think burnout is on the rise?
It's actually being called the occupational risk of today.
Wow.
And the World Health Organization is saying that by the year 2030, that stress-related illness is going to surpass communicable disease. So we're seeing the data suggest this worldwide epidemic, and they're actually calling today's work environments modern hazards.
Well, let me go back to you, Christina Maslach, because you have this inventory that you put together, as I mentioned, workload, control, reward, community, fairness, and values. We could spend the whole hour on them. But I think we tend to associate work overload with burnout. But what you have found is that it's much more complicated than that. Let's talk about control, or I guess lack of control.
All of these are essentially paths to burnout. I mean, really, those six areas are not burnout per se, but they represent areas where a misfit between people and their work can cause problems down the road. And certainly, workload is the biggest predictor of exhaustion per se. But with control, it really is the sense of, do you have some autonomy? Do you have some choice about how you do your work? Can you figure out, you know, solutions for this and be able to achieve them successfully? And when people are feeling that they don't have any control over what they do, that that they lack that ability to make choices, make decisions, et cetera, then there's just a whole long history, even before burnout, of research that shows that that can lead to a lot more stress for people.
Well, I'm thinking also about reward. I think we associate people's paycheck with reward, but you have found it's really much more than that. But if people don't feel that they are getting the reward that they are due or owed, that is, at least, as you say, a path to burnout.
A path, yeah. With reward, what we're finding, interestingly, is that really what we're talking about is more like recognition, that you're getting the feedback, and it's not just about being paid, but getting acknowledgement that you did something really well, or that you came through for somebody else and really helped out, or you developed something that really made a difference. And so the recognition from either your colleagues, from the people who you've, you know, clients or patients or, you know, people you're working for, some sort of thing that says, thank you, or we're so glad you're here, or that was really cool. That, you know, when you've done something that deserves that sort of thing is hugely important for people.
Well, Kristen, let me get you back in on the conversation. As I said, we've looked at a couple of these mismatches, but it does say something about the environment that people work in. How important is that environment, and does a dysfunctional environment create burnout?
Absolutely, Marty. Environment is everything. And I think, you know, we live at a time where oftentimes people are treated like commodities, like they're disposable. And to Christina's point, people really need a sense of that they're valued. They also, what we know from the research is that people need to feel security within their jobs and know that they're not just a number or a spoke in the wheel, but that their contributions are really important and that they're actually cared about. So those are all things that we know help lower the risk of burnout. And when we all think about it, it's just basic and primitive, right? You know, that we need to be validated and just know that the work and the time and energy we're investing is valuable. What we also know in what we've learned from modern brain science is that when people are in low trust, anxiety-provoking situations, it actually leads us to states that interfere with our focus and our creativity, our productivity, and engagement. So all those factors, you know, when we look at an environment and it's dysfunctional, really amplify anxiety and just a sense of stress and overwhelm and disengagement.
Christina, do you think there are certain types of jobs that are more highly correlated with burnout?
Oh, that's a good question. And it's hard to give a very precise answer on that, but I have to say that for many years, most of the interest and discussion around burnout has emerged from occupations where people have been involved in a lot of people work or people contact. So you're talking about things like healthcare and, you know, social services and teaching and all of these kind of things. Now, it's not clear that they are necessarily have the worst rates, but they certainly are the ones that have really talked about this and been involved in work to sort of deal with it, and particularly now a lot more on healthcare. But what we're finding is that people are responding and saying, yeah, I'm not there, but I'm hearing a lot, for example, from people in various IT kinds of occupations saying, we've got burnout, we've got issues, you know, and then describing what they're going through. So it seems to be that it's not, you know, something that's a risk just for certain occupations, but certain kinds of work situations, as Kristen was pointing out, which I think is really telling. And that's why we're saying it's, or people are noting that it's really more of an occupational risk in general in the workplace these days and not just specifically for certain jobs.
Well, Kristen, I'm thinking of low-wage workers. So you've got them, you know, largely underpaid. You've got oftentimes the difficulty of getting to and from work or childcare, probably less control on the environment. Do you think low-wage workers are at particular risk for burnout, and they probably have less options for what to do about it?
That's a good point, and I think there has actually been less research on low-wage workers, so I think they are probably underrepresented in the sense of the knowledge that we've gotten from them about this. But, you know, they are, whether or not you want to call it burnout, I mean, they have a lot more in terms of the stress, the uncertainty of whether they're going to keep a job, et cetera, that, you know, it's probably something much bigger than that.
Sure. What do you think, Kristen?
Yeah, so throughout my career, I've had the privilege of working with varied socioeconomic backgrounds, in particular underserved groups and people from lower socioeconomic situations. And certainly there's just multiple variables that they contend with, like you mentioned, transportation, but also that, you know, that choice limitation and, you know, the power over structures that dictate the work culture and the work situations, you know, giving people, again, less choice, less sense of agency. And then, you know, oftentimes having to work not only one job, but multiple jobs to put food on the table.
Kristen, you've also looked at resilience, and I want to make sure we discuss this in its in entirety. But what do you see as the connection between burnout and resilience? This is to you, Kristen. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, resilience, you know, just like burnout, we thought, or talking about it in terms of a process. So a lot of times the way that resilience has been conceptualized is like, you know, it's a matter of sheer will or individual choice. But we've also learned from the research and in modern brain science that resilience is something that can be cultivated. And again, so much of it has to do with looking at ourselves in our particular context and thinking about our role. So one of the things that I think is also important in this conversation is to remember that burnout doesn't just affect us within our professional arenas, but also personally within our roles. So we just talked a little bit about, you know, caregiving professions and the particular risks there. But lots of us are in complex roles. And we need to have the ability to adopt the mindsets and behaviors and develop the skills that we need to cultivate resilience, you know, to help us look at our context and to be proactive about it, you know, to make sure that we're really holding prevention in the fore of our thinking. And again, what I found in my clinical work in particular is that folks don't know how stressed they are until they show up with those symptoms.
Oh, interesting.
And so I like to think about it from like a universal precaution lens, right, that we all have to think about cultivating resilience and protecting ourselves.
Well, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about burnout, what it is, how to prevent it, how to deal with it. And that's Kristen Lee. She is lead faculty for behavioral science at Northeastern University, author of a book called Mentelligence, A New Psychology of Thinking. Christina Maslach is with us as well, and she created the Maslach Burnout Inventory that we were talking about. She's professor emerita of psychology at the University of California at Berkeley. And we want you to join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowing, talking with clinical social worker Kristen Lee and psychologist Christina Maslach about burnout. Well, Alex Neeson is a staff writer and Delacorte Fellow at Columbia Journalism Review and wrote an article for the review titled The Burnout Year about the stresses of being a journalist, of keeping up with the onslaught of news. And we wanted her to join our conversation. Alex Neeson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
What year was this? Your burnout year?
I think the year that it became apparent was, you know, 2016. I think that's kind of when a lot of people recognized it as such. But I think it was mentioned before that a lot of times these things sort of build up and you don't really realize you're in it until you're in it.
So speaking 2016 into 2017, so what were your symptoms? And you write about this.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think that the election year was just, you know, the 24-hour news cycle had existed for several years before that, and so I think that reporters, you know, as a profession had begun to adjust to that, but what we saw with the political process in that year was just so unusual. And that combined with the demands of the news cycle sort of, I think, heightened it for everyone. My symptoms, I think, and I didn't realize this until later, but I think that my symptoms began with a sort of cynicism, definitely, that, you know, you come to work and you read the news and you write the news and it's just bad, bad, bad all the time. And then I also started to experience some physical symptoms. I get headaches constantly. I started to have this sort of, I had this sort of phantom pain in my abdomen that I had begun seeing doctors for prior to that, and had been to many doctors in different states, and they had all said, there's nothing wrong with you, you're healthy. And so I've come to understand that as sort of a response to stress. And so it was sort of a combination of showing up at work and understanding that while I'm trying to get my stories done, I'm feeling a certain way, and also responding to physical pain.
Alex, hold on, because I want to get Christina Maslach back in on our conversation. Based on what Alex just described, both the physical and psychological symptoms, does that sound like burnout to you?
Yeah, sure. It does. What I would call the cynicism, because I think that is probably more the hallmark of burnout than, a lot of other kinds of stress experiences, which can also bring in the physical symptoms. But this cynical, hostile, you know, don't give a damn about, you know, the job kind of thing, and how that affects what you do on the job and how you respond to it is certainly an important part of burnout.
But do you also think, Christina, that as a reporter, you are, in a sense, sort of trapped in the news cycle? And I think for a lot of people that watch the news or read the news, also feeling trapped within this news cycle. Do you see that?
Yeah, you
do.
Yeah. So when you say feel trapped, any kind of thing that makes you feel that way is essentially making you feel you have no control over the environment. You don't have control over what you can do and how you can manage it in some way. And so that's, again, underscoring what we were saying before about this sense of autonomy, you know, and ability to sort of handle things is really critical.
Alex, going back to you and the article that you had in the Columbia Journalism Review, you did talk about feeling guilty about how you were feeling. How come?
Yeah, I think that there is this a sort of culture in journalism that we're tough and you show up and you do your job and you get it done. And there's this sort of unspoken rule that deviating from that, making any sort of complaint about how you're feeling is kind of looked down upon. To me, it felt sort of reflective of a newsroom culture that for a long time was very male dominated. And so this sort of quote man up attitude, I think, is one that I definitely bought into when I first got my first job in journalism. And so when you come to work and you realize that you're exhausted and you're struggling through stories and struggling really just to be there, you start to feel kind of guilty that you feel so lethargic, and you look around and wonder, is anyone else feeling this way? And if they don't look like they're feeling this way, then you start to wonder, well, what's the matter with me and why can't I handle it if everyone else is?
And you also say that your dad is a career Army officer, so there was something about sucking it up that maybe came with the family.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was definitely reflective of a military upbringing. And I think also, growing up a Black woman and living particularly in places that weren't always terribly diverse, you kind of learn that it's a survival tactic in some cases. And I think all of these things, all of these experiences that I had from kind of existing in the world as a Black person, from growing up in a military-focused culture to now entering a newsroom where in journalism the norm is get it done and don't complain about it, sort of snowball together to put me in a situation where maybe it's better for me to speak up and talk about how I'm feeling, and I wasn't necessarily equipped to do that.
Kristen, what do you make of that, the sort of tough it out, suck it up attitude? How does that relate or connect to burnout?
Well, as Alex said, it's a predominant theme in our individualistic culture, right? And so historically, you know, when someone's experiencing stress or burnout or any kind of mental health spectrum, there's a high stigma. And there is this idea that we have to be bootstrappers who suck it up and, you know, show up very polished and without any discussion of what's happening behind the scenes. And I think, there's a lot of dimensions to think about and to recognize that the biggest, what I would say is the biggest lie that anxiety or burnout can tell us is that we're the only ones. And when you just think about the particular context that you're describing, Alex, right? So all the factors, you know, I was pretty astonished at a data point that I saw that said that we now take in the equivalent of 174 newspapers a day, you know, the general population. So then for you within the industry, you know, to think of the overload and the tax on our brains, right? But we're just sort of expected to hyperperform. And again, you know, I work with lots of different professional affiliations and lots of people in varied roles where that expectation is not only implicit, but it's very well defined and well known that you're not supposed to, you know, lag behind or experience difficulty.
Alex, I'm curious about, did you hear from other journalists who said, yeah, I felt that way as well?
Oh, yeah. I think it sort of began, and I'm not sure what made people start to kind of talk about it. I guess it took one person saying something, and then just in talking with friends of mine, people that I work with, and also just friends who work in other newsrooms, and you sort of slowly start to understand that, oh, I'm not going to the gym the way I used to either. I feel lethargic every day. I'm constantly tired. I'm starting to skip meals. I go to work and it just feels horrible. And you start to talk with your colleagues and your friends about it. And then, yes, over time, you start to understand, like, okay, it's not just me, even though it can very much feel like that when you're sort of in the thick of it.
Christina, one of your mismatches is about communities. Talk about that in the context of what Alex just said. About the, I guess, the importance of feeling that you're part of a community at work, but right. also that you can share some of the anxieties that you might be feeling with your fellow coworkers. Christina?
Right. I think it's a very important point. What people were just saying, I just wanted to say, is that I think that in the United States, we glorify stress. You know, if you can't take the heat, get out of the kitchen. And, you know, we have stress tests to weed out the top people from the whatever. It's much more so than I've seen in other nations, cultures, and so forth. So I think there is something like that is a real problem. In terms of the community, the thing that is really I'm finding very distressing these days is that I'm seeing increasingly a kind of a culture of fear that you don't dare share anything about yourself with other people because, you know, that might mark you as weak. It might stigmatize you. You might not keep your job. People will put you down. If anything, people say when I have reached out and tried to talk to people about some of these things, you know, it's kind of like they say, well, you know, that's your problem. Don't bother me. And you know, when you feel better later, take care of yourself. We'll go out and have a beer. But that's about it. And the fact that that kind of thing is happening is really eroding the power of other people, of colleagues, of friends, of family, of neighbors, et cetera, to help each other out, have each other's back, and be able to say, gee, I haven't figured out the best solution to this problem, or I'm wondering if I really did the right thing in talking with this particular client, and being able to, consult with other people about this and not be afraid to share it. But I'm hearing this from all kinds of sectors, hearing it from people in IT, from people in healthcare, from people in all sorts of industries where they're saying that it's a toxic social environment. And when it's toxic, you don't want to stick out and you don't want to indicate that maybe you're quote unquote weak, as opposed to someone trying to find some other kinds of advice or guidance as to how they might move forward. And that's a very dangerous thing.
Sure is.
Other people are often, particularly people doing the same job, are often our very, very, very best resource. And things that break that and make it difficult, I think add to the risk of burnout.
Well, I should say, Alex, as you write, you talked to your mom, you talked to a friend, you did get some feedback, and it sounds like what you wrote at least allowed others in journalism to express some of the concerns that they have about being in the thick of news coverage.
Yeah, after I wrote that piece, I did hear from reporters, and I was somewhat surprised by this, that I, you know, got
DMs on Twitter or text messages or emails from other reporters working all over the place, just sort of thanking me for saying out loud that I hadn't been feeling good. And they wrote that it sort of freed them to more openly talk about some of the similar things that they had been feeling.
Do you feel less burned out, Alex?
I think
the news continues, I should say. Right.
Yeah. I think that I feel differently than I did when I first sat down to write this piece. But, you know, the sort of the drama of the world and the stress of the news cycle continues and it changes every day. I think that I have gotten much better at learning sort of how to deal with it or learning how to cope with it. I'm definitely better at talking about it with my friends and family. And there's sort of these little things that now I try when I start to feel overwhelmed to try to prevent myself from getting to the very low place that I had been previously.
Well, I appreciate
doing better.
Absolutely. And I appreciate you joining us today in Radio Times and talking about it as well. Thanks so much, Alex.
Thank you.
And that's Alex Neeson, staff writer, Delacorte Fellow at Columbia Journalism Review, talking about an article she wrote titled The Burnout Year. And we are continuing our conversation with Christina Maslach, who identified six mismatches that can lead to burnout. It's called the Maslach Burnout Inventory. Also with us, Kristen Lee has done a lot of work on burnout and resilience and well-being. And we carry on our conversation with them. And you can join us, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Kristen, let me just pick up. Alex talked about things that she's doing to make herself able to cope with some of the stresses of her job. What do you suggest? What tends to work for people in general when they're feeling that sense of burnout?
So there's really not a one size fits all, but when we look at the research and we think about resilience, what we want to do is identify protective factors. So the things that actually help contribute to our sustainability in both our personal and professional roles. So some of the things that we see overwhelmingly as being protective include our relationships. So we've been talking about that, you know, really in the middle of it all, right, and all the chaos, to try to find ways to strengthen our relationships. Some studies have shown that just the presence of a supportive partner is a protective factor, but also access to a social network outside the workplace. And I think this is sort of challenging, right, because, again, when we're under the gun and we have so many things that we're juggling, sometimes it's hard to actually make time to have the relationships.
Right.
But also, you know, to find the relationships, you know, to Christina and Alex's points around, you know, places where we can have a sense of trust. I think organizations in general could, you know, really benefit folks if they create a culture of help seeking and help giving. You know, so sort of normalizing, again, when we think about this risk factor of today, it's not a moral failing on someone's part. It's not a sign of weakness. But we really need to, you know, provide the context and situations where people are known to thrive.
Christina, what then, from your perspective, what can organizations do and what can individuals do if they're feeling just completely overwhelmed?
Well, it's a good question, because I think that more of the focus has been on what individuals can do, and yet what we're facing is that there's this larger environment that goes beyond individuals that is creating some of the problems. So we really need to think about how can we make improvements within the workplace so that we are actually building up these kind of resources and protective factors. And the six areas that I mentioned, which, by the way, are not the MBI per se, but areas of work life, the mismatches, can actually give us some ideas. And so things about how do you build a greater sense of support and trust and having opportunities for people to get to know each other and work well together, et cetera, in the workplace, that this isn't a really important thing. How do we do a better job of letting people know when they've done something well, as well as trying to correct and improve things when they don't do it as well? So looking at issues around fairness, which are turn out to be another important area. Are you being treated fairly? Are there other issues that can be addressed on that score? Or just the meaning in the work. I mean, mm-hmm. Trying to find things that create more positive experiences for people at work that keep them motivated and keep them going forward. In terms of individual factors, I think much of the emphasis has been on how to keep yourself healthy and, you know, strong and all that kind of thing. But as many people have pointed out, when you're working that hard with so many demands and with those kinds of stressors, it's sometimes hard to get more sleep and eat better and, you know, and all of those kind of things. So we need to look at the more sort of social dynamics as well as just the individual ones.
Kristen, do you want to add to that?
Sure. So again, you know, if we're looking at things that employers can do, there are a lot of things, you know, although I think there's a lot of companies that are doubling down now and trying to bolster productivity, like they'll bring work and lunch in for everybody so they don't leave the building. So there's certainly those cultures. But also we're seeing a lot of evidence of places who are really shifting and understanding the impact of stress on burnout, on productivity and engagement. Biogen is an interesting example out of Cambridge. They actually implemented a concierge service for employees.
Really?
So they actually helped them run errands, secure pet sitters, get their shoes fixed.
Oh, my goodness.
And what they found was it actually saved employees 12.5 hours a week. And then they saw an increase in productivity and also a decrease in voluntary departure, so falling from 14 to 5%. So I think we're seeing a lot of evidence, and just in the similar way of Alex, you know, really being brave and courageous and to talk about her personal narrative. We've seen lots of examples of thought leaders out there who are also really just talking about these risks. One prime example is Arianna Huffington, right? So she owned the Huffington Post. She was on 24/7, and it wasn't until she collapsed and broke her cheekbone and woke up in a pool of blood that she recognized that she needed to make changes. So she actually now heads up Thrive Global, which is a worldwide organization really championing burnout prevention. You know, the other big thing
well, you know
is...
what? Hold on to that thought only because we're up on a very short break here and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Kristen Lee, and she's lead faculty for behavioral science at Northeastern University, wrote a book called Mentelligence, A New Psychology of Thinking. Also with us, Christina Maslach, and she is a psychologist, professor emerita of psychologists at the University of California, Berkeley, a pioneer, one of the leading authorities on burnout. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about burnout, stress, heavy workload, some of the reasons for burnout, which can include things like powerlessness or feeling disrespected or unsatisfied on the job. And again, our guests are Christina Maslach and Kristen Lee. You can join us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. I do want to get to the callers, but Kristen, I want to just give you a chance to finish the point you were making right before the break.
Absolutely. So just another thing that an employer can do is to actually do something that the literature defines as job crafting. So that's just a way of saying that if we work to ensure that an employer's skills and interests and their values are aligned with their tasks, that can really be a protective factor. And what we know is that a higher level of skill use is actually associated with lower levels of depression. So we really want people to have the chance to have tasks that are motivating and challenging to really increase positive engagement.
Let me just throw in another question. I want to toss this to you, Christina, talking about this relationship that we have with our environment at work. How about things like ergonomics, you know, making sure that we have chairs that are comfortable and things that are at the right height? How much does that factor into a possibility of burnout or preventing burnout, if I can put it that way? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. What's interesting is about ergonomics is that, you know, this has actually been around for a while, and the sense of the fit or the misfit between the person and the job. And how do we reduce that mismatch and make a better fit? In terms of the physical environment, as you say, having, you know, the right kind of chair or, you know, light or, computer workstation or whatever it happens to be. Essentially, what I am trying to argue with regard to burnout is you need to extend that model to the psychological and social environment. That's where we're seeing the mismatches and the misfits, you know, that are predictive of burnout. And so putting people in job situations that they cannot control, where they don't get trust and support and feedback, where they're being treated unfairly, et cetera, is an example of kind of we're not using the ergonomic, you know, model in a more comprehensive way to really bolster people's ability and strength and really allow them to thrive.
I mean, you really are describing what sounds to me like a toxic work environment. People don't feel disrespected. They don't have control over their work life, and on and on and on. That's toxic.
Yeah. No, I think that's probably how many people are describing their work environments now. I mean, the word socially toxic keeps not just physically toxic,
right,
you know, in the sense of being exposed to, you know, physical harm or something like that, but the social. And that just keeps coming up over and over and over again in a lot of what we do. Socially toxic is part of what makes people feel stigmatized, makes them feel they don't want to talk about this. And, you know, just like you were saying earlier, the first time I ever published anything based on the interviews I had done on this sort of new phenomenon that people were sort of talking about burnout, I got overwhelmed with responses, people saying, oh, my God, I thought I was the only one.
Wow.
And now I know that there are maybe others out there. So that social conversation, that social environment that allows us to sort of face up to issues or problems and say, how can we do this better, is really what we need at this point.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we are social creatures. Let me get Sean from Haddon Township to join us on Radio Times. And, Sean, go ahead. You're on the air. You've been very patient. Thanks so much.
Hi, thank you. I've been enjoying the discussion. It's amazing.
Great.
It's something I think about all the time. I work in healthcare, and listening to the to your talkers, your professionals, I mean, they're hitting all of the amazing points that if our work environment had them every day, that many of us that work in healthcare, especially physicians, probably wouldn't be living with. I think a lot of us are having challenges because we have less autonomy. We're asked to do more and more and more, faster. And we're looking around and we're seeing other people, other professionals that we work with, nurses in the hospital, other managers, that are getting opportunities to go and get their, let's say, MBA paid for or a master's of health administration paid for by the hospital. And then they're able to move forward. And so we're asked to be the workhorses a lot of times. And we're looking around and there's no real opportunity for professional growth.
Well, that's so interesting. Yeah, and Sean, it sounds like, are you a physician yourself?
I am.
You are. That's very interesting.
Yeah.
And actually, Christina, you had mentioned healthcare earlier. Let me give you a chance to respond to Sean. He's saying, you know, I look around me and I see people making moves for advancement. I don't see that same thing in front of me.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
so
that's an interesting issue, and I see it in areas other than healthcare as well. But there's somehow a funny kind of thing that as people move into certain roles or if they go higher up, they get the perks. But the perks don't extend to everybody or, you know, in a more broad way, saying everyone here has a chance to grow and develop and do more and so forth. And how do we tap into that? How do we make that happen? I think there is this issue, I think, of people often not being recognized for what they can contribute and really being viewed as a resource that you want to have grow and develop. And how do we do that in a more fair and more systematic and more inclusive way.
Sean, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Kristen, I know you want to say something, but it's interesting. We tend to think of physicians as at the top of the hierarchy when it comes to healthcare, but he's not feeling it.
Mm-hmm.
Kristen?
That's right. Yeah, no, I've worked with a lot of physicians, nurses, those in helping professions, other social workers, psychologists, and there's certainly that element of folks thinking, you know, it's stress-free at that level where, that's furthest from the case, really. And, you know, I think the point is that, you know, at the end of the day, people need chances to flourish, and we have the brain science. We're not in the 1950s, right? So we have the brain science that talks about ways we can flourish, and one of the greatest things we can do is have chances for upward mobility and ongoing growth and advancement, and as has been said, just choice, you know, the ability to make choices. I think, again, these particular, for you, Sean, and your colleagues, there is that particular stigma, right? And I think that, again, What we need to do, what we see in the literature, is we need to, you know, create educational programs, you know, public awareness around these risks across professions. And then what we also have learned is that something called supervised skill practice is essential. So that's just a way of saying that we need to provide opportunities for people to practice self-care skills, practice appropriate disclosure, you know, to think about their professional goals and advancement and make sure that, you know, they have those check-ins around just even the basic lifestyle medicine strategies. You know, are you getting proper sleep? Are you hydrated? Are you moving enough? All those things that really we know help people to thrive rather than be at risk for burnout.
Interesting. I mean, sort of big and little things together. Sean, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Let me see what Harry from Northeast Philadelphia has to say. And Harry, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I left my job in 2001. I worked in what I would call a very hostile work environment. I had a meltdown, and eventually I wound up in the hospital. Wow. And even during my times before retiring, I had periodic visits to hospitals and stuff. And it just seemed like people were looking for the weakest link. And the weakest perceived person in the population, and they would just pick at you and pick at you and pick at you. And I would hide myself in work and try not to respond to just constantly being picked on, and you know, I felt very mistreated. I just felt I couldn't even. I wouldn't dare confide in anybody at work because I don't even think the managers or administrations are aware that they have a sick environment that needs attention.
Absolutely, Harry. I really appreciate the call, and I'm sorry to hear what you went through. Let me go back to you, Christina. And I think I'm looking at the computer here. His last job was in the prison system before all that abuse. But nonetheless, talk about a mismatch here.
Yes. Yeah. No, it's true, and it goes back, I think, partly to the point that was raised earlier that the sense of a more general work culture that glorifies stress, that really divides the world up into those who are strong, who are good, and the rest of us who are not. When you have that kind of strong, weak dichotomy, then, you know, there's something about our culture which becomes very punitive towards the people who are number two, number 55, as opposed to number one. It leads to the kind of bullying that he was just talking about. It leads to other things that really don't actually focus on how do you, you know, make this better, get this person to get, you know, to become more of a contributor and so forth, but really just to get rid of these people. And I once spoke to somebody who said, oh, I like burnout. I think it's great. And I said, why is that? And they said, well, because then people will quit voluntarily and I don't have to fire them.
Whoa.
So there was this sense of, if people experience that there must be something wrong with them, they're not so good, I get somebody else, you know, this kind of set of beliefs which get, you know, practiced.
And imagine working under that person who valued burnout. I appreciate the call, Harry, to Radio Times. Kristen, here's a couple of comments here. One from Margo says, maybe people just weren't meant to sit all day in cubicles. How much do you think that's a factor, Kristen?
So the research really overwhelmingly suggests that movement is just such a vital part of our lifeblood, right? And so, again, they're calling it now lifestyle medicine. There's institutes popping up all around the world just helping us with some of those basic things like, you know, the idea that our brains aren't meant to take in so much information and be on our screen so much and to be sitting. So that's certainly a vital point, absolutely.
An email from Sherry, she says, not to simplify the issue you're discussing, but more attention needs to be focused on creating work environments where people thrive. Ask employees, they will know how to make the workplace better. Christina, based on your research,
yes.
is that true? You said yes.
Absolutely. And here, that's a very good point. And I just want to sort of underscore this, that what I'm seeing often is that people are not actually asking people about their work. They're coming in with things that are top down. Oh, let me put in, maybe we should have a gym in the basement, you know, some, you know, cycles and stuff like that. And people, you know, you can go down there and work out. And if you ask the employees, they will say, that's not what we need. You know, what we need is something over here. This would make a difference. So in many sense, this top-down, not listening, not asking, not understanding from the people who are doing the work, what might be, you know, 50 different ways to make it a little bit better. I think that's a really important issue. They've got a lot of insights. They know what will make, you know, this improvement. And the fact that you're giving them the respect to actually participate in this discussion and be part of the solution rather than just having something done to us, you know, I think it's an important point.
Sounds like you're saying, Christina, ask them. They will tell you, right?
Yes.
Kristen,
they
let me
certainly can, as long as they feel that if they're being asked, they're not going to be punished or stigmatized for raising problems and saying there's a better way, and can we try those?
Kristen, let me turn back to you. We actually did a show recently about how Americans don't take the vacations, even the vacation days that they have earned. This gets us, Kristen, this gets us to discussing, I mean, what we need to do, I guess, to take better care of ourselves, including, I guess, using the benefits that we are owed. Can you speak to that, Kristen?
Absolutely. I wrote an article called Why Waiting for Your Next Vacation to Unwind Might Be Dangerous. And so some of the work that's come out of Harvard actually frames, you know, our daily practices as break rituals. So these are, you know, and again, going back to Alex's narrative, right? It's like, you know, there's certain things we can't control. We can't control the news cycle, but it's how do we put into place each day, you know, things that we hold sacred, you know, setting boundaries around so we make sure that we're having, even if it's the 10 minutes of mindfulness meditation or the 20-minute walk, but it's making sure that we're getting those anchors in throughout our day and not kind of waiting until that next deadline is finished. You know, there's always in our adult life something that's coming around the corner at us, right? So we need that agility, mm-hmm. We need that ability to sort of maneuver that. And one way we can do that is when we're regularly practicing the self-care. And again, one big piece of self-care from a mindset perspective is watching out for the trappings of perfectionism. This is something that's come out of my research and just looking at the difference between, you know, striving, right? You want to strive for excellence, but, you know, knowing the difference between a job well done and getting burnt out, and knowing the difference between caring and caring to the point of self-destruction. And what the research shows is that if we're focused on hyper-performance and we're not making room for that self-care, we're really putting ourselves at a greater risk for stress, exhaustion, burnout. And we're also not, you know, thinking about how do we sustain ourselves across our professional and personal roles. And I always tell, you know, my students and those I consult and work with is that, you know, you can't sprint through a marathon. We have to sort of do this pacing.
Well, and that's coming from a quote-unquote recovering perfectionist, right, Kristen?
Yes, yes. And like Alex, you know, I'm a behavioral science expert. I have 22 years of mental health outpatient work. It's my research area. But I also went public with my own story of burnout and my own lived experiences with anxiety and depression. And I think anyone who's in a leadership role, you know, again, we're often taught to, you know, kind of show up shiny and, you know, very contained. But I think it's also really important for us to acknowledge the experience of our shared humanity, right?
Yes. And on that note, we have to, we have to end our conversation. Kristen Lee, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure. Take care.
You too. And her book is called Mentelligence, A New Psychology of Thinking. Christina Maslach, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Oh, thank you.
And she's Professor Emerita of Psychology at the University of California at Berkeley, and she is the author of the Maslach Burnout Inventory. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Sign up for our newsletter. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.